At this time, I'd like you to open your Bibles back to the book of Ecclesiastes. This morning, we're looking at Ecclesiastes chapter 8. Ecclesiastes chapter 8. When I was a young boy, I thought that my dad was perfect. I actually thought for a period of time that my dad never sinned. I did as a young boy. He would tell me things and I would listen and I would disobey him. And I realized, wow, I'm not really a very good boy sometimes, but my dad, he is like up here. And maybe in my own life, my kids for a short period of time thought the same thing. But there came a time in my life when my dad had to share with me that, you know what, son, I'm not perfect. I struggle with the same sinful things that you do. And I don't know if you ever had that moment in your life, whether you had Christian parents or maybe you come from a bad background and your parents never made any pretense about being sinners and they sinned with a high hand. I don't know. Maybe your parents are from an atheist or a completely different religion. But for me, in a Christian family, I was shocked. I really was. I remember stopping and thinking about it as a boy. My dad struggles with sin? Now, the text that we're looking at today, Ecclesiastes chapter 8, the main theme of it is the problem with authority. There is a problem with authority in the land. All authority, but specifically to this chapter, governmental authority. And that problem is the exact thing that my dad pointed out to me and I have pointed out to my kids. That problem is sin. Dads struggle to be the dads they should be because they're sinners. When you move to a different realm of relationships and you think of the husband-wife relationship and the fact that the husband is supposed to be the head of the home, that's the Christian worldview. The wife submits to the husband. And our wives struggle, men, because we're sinners. And it's hard to submit to a sinful man. Paula and I kind of have an agreement that I've told her I'll never be perfect, and she said that she'll be satisfied with a growing husband. And that's kind of a good outlook for a wife. Never a perfect husband, but as long as your husband's growing. But it does point out the fact that husbands sin. That there are times when they make decisions that are selfish. And certainly that's the same way with our government. Not just the American government, but any government. If you look at our text today and you look down at verse 9... It says in verse 9, "All this have I seen and applied my heart unto every work that is done under the sun. There is a time wherein one man ruleth over another to his own hurt." The idea is there is authority. The one man has it over another, but he can practice it in such a way that that person is harmed. And that really is the point of chapter 8. What do you do with sinful authority? It's a mess out there right now. But that's never really changed. And when I say out there, I'm not really specifically referring to American government or just American government. What about the government of Indonesia? What about the government of Zaire's not here anymore. But what about the government of South Africa or Australia or Britain or Ireland? What about the government of the governments of the Middle East? Iraq, Iran, even Israel. It's all flawed. And here we are as Christians living in the midst of it. What are we supposed to do? So the passage kind of breaks down this way. There is sort of the value of wisdom that he hints out in chapter 8, verse 1. And then he starts talking about the problem of a flawed governmental authority, how to respond to irresistible governance, really, is what he talks about in the first few verses. Then he talks about the characteristics of flawed government. such as political manipulation, delayed justice, and injustice. Sounds like something out of today's headlines. He encourages God-fearers in verses 12 to 13. What are we supposed to do? And then we see sort of the worldly man's hope or perspective in verse 15. And in verses 16 to 17, he just hammers on the limitations of wisdom. There's sort of the value of wisdom is the top, and then it's kind of all the stuff about government and then sandwiched in there. And then at the bottom there's, yes, but there are limitations to wisdom. And so what we're going to see this morning is that we're looking at a man who is a realist, who looks out there at government and sees that it is deeply flawed, but he's still hopeful. Are you hopeful this morning? Let's see what we find in how Solomon responds to this. So let's look down, and what we're going to do first is just read the first verse. Who is as the wise man? And who knoweth the interpretation of a thing? A man's wisdom maketh his face to shine, and the boldness of his face shall be changed. The Hebrew there that's translated boldness could also be translated sternness. Here is someone that you see walking down the street, and their expression is grim. Their countenance could be changed if there is wisdom. Wisdom can make his face shine. It's almost as if Solomon is in his kingdom and he's walking down the street and he's looking at all these people with all these grim expressions on their faces. And he's thinking to himself, if they only had wisdom, they would be happy. Their expression right on their face would change. Now, you and I walk through the world together. We walk through Green Valley Marketplace down there. We walk through the Giant up here. We might go up to Arundel Mills and we'll walk through the mall and we might walk into work. Have you ever looked at the expressions of people's faces? On a Monday morning, what are they like? On a Friday night, when work is almost over and it's time to party for the weekend, they might have a little joy. But the question is, on a Monday morning, what are they like? You might say, well, Pastor, my expression on a Monday morning is not that great. You say, well, I understand how you feel. But really, here's where we're beginning into this chapter. Do you believe that your actual emotional state, that you could get some joy out of what you're about to hear? That's what he's saying. All right, first, he's going to talk about irresistible government. Verse 2, I counsel thee to keep the king's commandment. And that in regard of the oath of God, be not hasty to go out of his sight. Stand not in an evil thing, for he doeth whatsoever pleaseth him. That is, the king does whatever he wants. Verse 4. Where the word of a king is, there's power or authority. And who may say unto him, what doest thou? Whoso keepeth the commandment shall feel no evil thing. And a wise man's heart discerneth both time and judgment. That's a fascinating statement. Do you know what that's talking about? Bureaucracy. Amazing statement. Because to every purpose there is time and judgment, therefore the misery of man is great upon him, for he knoweth not that which shall be, for who can tell him when it shall be? There is no man that hath power or authority over the spirit to retain the spirit. Neither hath he power or authority in the day of death. And there is no discharge in that war. Neither shall wickedness deliver those who are given to it. All right, now think, follow this now. There is spirit or wind, and no one has authority over it. Verse 8. There is the day of death, and no one has authority over it. There is war, and you might be enlisted, and you don't have the authority to change that. And there is this built-in punishment to wickedness. If you go out and you get drunk and you crash your car and kill someone and you're a paraplegic the rest of your life, you have no authority to undo those wicked acts. The consequences of some things can never be undone. Verse 8 is his illustrations to the nature of irresistible governance. Now, we live in a country that is free. We pride ourselves at being in such a country. But is it not so that there is a sense in which American government is irresistible? I mean, there are times when a decision is made, and yes, we have representational government. We can do things in the state house. We can petition people in the Senate. We can write emails to the president's third secretary twice removed. But isn't there a time when it's suddenly, if there's that brick wall and some things won't change? Now, please understand, I am not advising you to become a cynic and to give up on petitioning our government for change. That's not what I'm saying. But is it possible to connect the dots between this idea of you can never lasso the wind? It's like trying to nail Jell-O to the wall. It's just impossible. You can't. There are certain things that you cannot resist. Now, directly in the context here, it's the king. Look back at your Bible again at verse 2. His counsel is keep the king's commandments. And that in regard of the oath of God. The king has an authority, and it's sort of tied into this oath and this idea that God is involved. So verse 3, don't be hasty to run out. Okay, I'll do whatever you say. And don't stand not in an evil thing, and don't persist in breaking a law. For he, the king, is going to do whatever he wants. You know, it's always a convicting thing when my kids tell me I'm going above the speed limit. Don't raise your hand if your little kids or your teenagers have ever looked at your speedometer and said, "Hey, Dad, why are you going above the speed limit?" You know, I've used those as moments to slow down, and I hope you do too. Generally speaking, I endeavor to obey the speed limit, even though I've had police officers tell me they won't pull me over if I go up to 10 miles per hour over the speed limit. I think that's not true, but as a Christian, I don't want to test that unwritten law. But we know that it's ridiculous to argue with the cop, right? And there is a certain amount of submission that we should have because he is there. You can't really resist him. I mean, look down at these, the way we can respond to government that's wrong in verse 2. The king has a command and you could just say no. That's one bad response. You know what? There's this rain tax thing. Oh, it's not a tax. It's a fee. We have a large roof. Look up. That's pretty big, isn't it? We have a lot of blacktop outside. You know what? As a church, we're just not going to pay. It's wrong. Could say no. It's not. But look at verse 2. What's Solomon's counsel? I counsel thee to keep the king's commandment. The other response, verse 3, is sort of a flippancy. Be not hasty to go out of his sight. I mean, it's sort of this whatever, and you go out and you're just sort of not really very diligent to dot your I's and cross your T's. You're just sort of careless with the king's command. We can kind of do that with the speed limit. We can do that with our taxes, how much we pay or don't pay. I mean, it's sort of the careless attitude about the king. You know, here's this person in Solomon's day, and Solomon was the king, who had a whole boatload of authority. And you're just going to be flipping about that? Sort of like just cursing the authority or saying just not being respectful to the authority? And then verse 3 gives the other response. If you are in the midst of an evil thing, I mean, you're right in the middle of it. And the king gives a command and it's about what you're doing. Don't persist in it. Stop. Don't persist. Stand not in an evil thing. And his counsel is based on the last clause of verse 3. For he, the king, is going to do whatever he wants. You break a law and you continue to break that law, eventually you will be caught. And after a while, we're going to look at Romans 13 and see the New Testament version of this. Now, having said that, and in verses 4-7, having talked about how irresistible this government is by using these different illustrations, he then talks about the harm that it does. And that is verses 9, 10, 11, and 14. So let's look at the harm that he brings out here. He says in verse 9, "All this have I seen and applied my heart unto every work that is done under the sun. There is a time wherein one man ruleth over another to his own hurt." So this, again, as I mentioned before, is the personal harm that someone can do in government to you and me. A good Old Testament illustration of this is poor Uriah the Hittite. Here's King David. He commits adultery and he has a whole lot of authority. And so he can tell Joab to send Uriah home. And then he tries to manipulate Uriah into going home, having relations with his wife so that he can claim that the child is Uriah's child. And Uriah refuses. So David has authority to bring him back and to send him out to the war. And David has authority for Uriah to carry in his own hands his death warrant. Put Uriah to the front of the battle. And yes, it was a great deal of personal harm when those rocks fell off the wall and crushed his skull, or that arrow pierced his armor and went into his lung or his heart. That's a great deal of personal harm. And so it is that you and I can personally feel that in some way. You look down a little further at verse 10. "And so I saw the wicked buried who had come and gone from the place of the holy. And they were forgotten in the city where they had so done. And this is also vanity." Now, here we have someone who is wicked and he's buried and everyone thought he was holy. Now, you put this in the context of politics and the problems of irresistible, sinful government, and what you have is a false reputation that's been built up over the years. And when he dies, he's wicked, but everyone still thinks he was a good man. It always fascinates me to hear Christians talk about the presidents of the United States. And it's sort of, it fascinates me and grieves me to hear about pundits and historians abroad and out here talk about our presidents. I wonder what God will say about them. Who was a righteous president? Who was a president of integrity? Who is a president whose grave is he's looked upon by historians as the holy and just president? And yet you say, "Well, Dan, who are you talking about?" I'm not talking about any specific president. I assure you, in my brain right now, I'm not thinking of four or five presidents. I'm just putting this out here. Isn't it so that it's possible to build a political persona and present this false persona to the American people? This happened in the Old Testament. If this was a Sunday school class, I'd ask you if you could remember, and you probably could remember, Absalom. Here we have Absalom standing outside the courthouse. And the people are coming, and Absalom is basically just loving the people, shaking the hands, kissing the babies. I mean, everybody's coming, and he's like, "Hey, how are things going with this system?" "Oh, not too good. Well, I wish I was in charge. I could do something." And he won the hearts of the people. But how did the Bible, at the end of the story, who was that man? Should he come from the place of the holy and be buried as a holy individual? He was able to manipulate the people, and he was good at doing it, so much so that when the day came for him to break off from his father and rebel openly, open civil war, he had a following. Folks, he couldn't have done it alone. Rah, rah for Absalom, rah, rah for Absalom. There he is over there in a corner by himself. People look at him like, "What? He had an army. He had people who followed him because he was able to practice the art of political manipulation. He was successful at it. Wouldn't you call that successful? An attempted civil war? David on the run? This is a problem with sinful government. Verse 11 talks about delayed justice. Look at verse 11. Because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. Now, this is a principle that I think is also found in the Proverbs. If you have someone who committed a crime and you know they committed the crime and you wait and you wait and you wait and you wait before finally they receive justice, what do the other bad guys tend to think? He's getting away with it. Years he's sitting there on death row. Well, you know what? It took that guy 5 years just to get to court to have his case heard. And according to this, look at it again. Let it sink in. Verse 11. Because a sentence, that is a legal sentence against an evil work, is not executed speedily, the hearts of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. Delayed justice. Now, one of the worst times in the history of Israel when this took place was the days of the judges. Because there was such a every man was doing what was right in his own eyes in Israel because there was no king. And God raised up these judges to do a work. And yet each of them was very sinful, for the most part, in their responses to their jobs. One of these examples, of course, would be Samson. Here's a man who's so tied up with his desire for this woman and that woman. He's so ruled by his physical appetites that you can only wonder what kind of justice existed in Israel during his days as a judge. Where's Samson? Well, I think he's out there getting all these animals, and he's going to tie stuff to their tails, and he's going to put fire to the Philistines. Oh, yeah, I think he's way over there with Delilah. I mean, I'm not really sure where Samson was and how he executed judgment during his days. Whenever you have someone who's a leader and a judge and deeply flawed in their moral character, folks, please don't ever think that a leader's character is irrelevant to their practice of their authority. Please don't ever think that. The scriptures are clear that a leader's character does count. Samson possessed character that was deeply flawed. And so we know the end of the story. Chained between two pillars with his eyes gouged out, and he dies. Yes, he took many Philistines with him in his death, but certainly it was not the will of God that it took place that way. And then finally, in verse 14, there is just injustice. And I'm skipping down to verse 14 because I'm going to save the God-fearer's hope and the advice he gives in a moment. It says in verse 14, there is a vanity which is done upon the earth, that there be just men unto whom it happeneth according to the work of the wicked. Again, there be wicked men to whom it happeneth according to the work of the righteous. I said that this also is vanity. Now, this is a little different than chapter 7. In chapter 7, he was talking about just people who were good and then they just died. And people that were evil and they just kept living and living and living. This is talking about, look at it again in verse 14, there be just men. All right, there the emphasis is on their good, their right, and it happeneth according to the work of the wicked. Now, in the context, this is probably a reference to someone who is unjustly called to account for things he did not do. Now, one of the fascinating things about our legal system in the last 50 years has been the advent of DNA evidence. And so there have been case after case of people coming forward and evidence being reexamined. And yes, folks, it does happen. Innocent people at least innocent of the crime that they were accused of, go to jail sometimes. I worked with a guy. This is a terrible story. He went to prison. He went to the local jail in Greenville, South Carolina, to visit his cousin. He went through the front door, and they asked for his ID, and he gave them their ID, you know, like they do when you visit someone in jail. And immediately, the guards started looking, whispering to themselves, looking at him. And he was just standing there. They came out, they handcuffed him. They didn't say anything to him. Handcuffed him and said, "You're coming with us." He's like, "What? I'm just trying to visit my cousin. What's going on here?" They took him to the back room, and they said, "Son, it's good to see you again." "Good to see me again?" "Yep." And they took him in, and they locked him up. And he hardly knew what was going on. This is a true story. It turned out that he shared the same name with a criminal who had jumped his probation in that area. And so when they saw the name, the computer matched it up, and they jumped on it, and they grabbed him. This poor guy, this innocent family man, who was going to the jail to visit his cousin — he was a Christian too, by the way — probably going to encourage his cousin to follow the Lord. He spends the weekend dressed as a criminal in jail, sharing a cell with another criminal. He said all he did all weekend was throw up. That's a true story. Do innocent people sometimes go to jail? Yes, they do. It does happen. So these are the problems that we face as Christians. Our government, because they are at times irresistible, can bring us to personal harm. David did it with Uriah. Our government can, through political manipulation, make a candidate seem like an angel when he's really the devil. Our government, any government, can delay justice, which is probably what took place under the days of Samson. And any government, our government, can be unjust. Innocent people can end up going to jail for things they did not do. What does Solomon say we should do about it? That's where verses 12 to 13 come in. Look at those. "Though a sinner do evil 100 times and his days be prolonged, yet surely I know that it shall be well with them that fear God, which fear before him. But it shall not be well with the wicked, neither shall he prolong his days, which are as a shadow, because he feareth not before God." Now, this is an interesting statement, given all the other things perhaps you remember that Solomon has already written about the nature of sin and its consequences. Because just last time he pointed out that, hey, that life isn't fair, because there are times when the good guys die and the bad guys live. But here he's going back to this, and it's a comfort to him. And I have to tell you that he's doing this because he's not just talking about justice in this life. The scriptures reveal to us in the New Testament that it is appointed unto man once to die, and after this, the judgment. Every individual will face a holy and a righteous God. Unlike human judges — by the way, this is not a critical analysis of every judge that ever lived, and I'm not trying to criticize everything. This is only basic characteristics Solomon is saying here, problems with government. But unlike a human judge, God knows most of the stuff in this universe. What do you think, 50%? No, all of it, everything. Every detail of every crime, every sin, both small and great, from the time when you stole something from the store — I'm not saying you, but the time when an individual stole something from the store and then took it back and returned it because he felt guilty — to Hitler's crimes, to Stalin's crimes, every one God has seen. And when you and I stand before the eternal, omniscient, omnipotent God, we can't manipulate him. We're not going to be able to say, Are you sure you got your facts right, God? Because I think on Tuesday at 2 o'clock, I was really at my grandmother's house. She was baking me cookies. I don't think I could have been over there with my girlfriend. Not going to be able to be said. No excuses. No wiggling your way out of it. Before God, you have the only time, folks, that you have irresistible governance and absolute truth combined. Think of this. We sometimes face irresistible government in this life, but we've never faced irresistible truth, absolute truth before. When you and I stand before him one day, they are perfectly combined in the Trinity, and he will with absolute precision give his verdicts. Guilty, not guilty. And every tongue will confess that it's right. Even those who are trying to wiggle their way out of it. That is a comfort, verse 12. Yet surely I know that it shall be well with them that fear God, which fear before him. That is intended to comfort those of us in this room who fear God, who truly fear him. We're Christians, and we've been brought into this new relationship with God through Jesus Christ. And if we could put it this way, if we were to face judgment, and there is, although we won't face the great white throne judgment, there is a sense in which we will face the ultimate God of justice. And we admit already, hey, he's right. I'll tell you before he even says it, guilty. We admit it as Christians. Because we fear God. And then we say, but Lord, look, just like John the Baptist said, behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. God of justice, you sent him to die in my place. Justice was served on him. But, verse 12, the sinner, even if he does evil 100 times and his days be prolonged, it's not going to go well with him on that day, will it? The one who has rejected Christ and Christ's gospel, he will stand there and he will be guilty and he will not be able to say the cross because he has never put his trust in it. And he has loved his sin and continues to embrace it. And at that point, his days will be cut short when he is thrown into an eternal death apart from God and the presence of his angels, where the smoke and the torment rises forever. So Solomon in this passage, he seems to be alluding more to that. Now, in his Hebrew mind, Sheol and the grave and the finality of a person facing God there than the temporary nature of justice in this life. So where does that take us? Well, when you continue through the passage and you look down at verses 16 to 17, he's back, and I'm going to have to hurry here. I'm going to have to skip over verse 15, not because I want to, but because we just don't have time. Because I want to get to a real point here. Verses 16 and 17, he just says, when I applied mine heart to know wisdom and to see the business that is done upon the earth, for also there is that neither day nor night seeth sleep with his eyes. Then I beheld all the work of God, that a man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. Because though a man labor to seek it out, yet he shall not find it. Yea, further, though a wise man think to know it, yet shall he not be able to find it. At the beginning of the chapter, he gave us a plus for wisdom. You know what? Wisdom can make you feel better and your face will show it. But at the end of the chapter, he's saying, you know what? I really tried with wisdom to completely understand this issue with wisdom alone, and I just could not do it. The end of verse 17. Yet shall he not be able to find it. Now, that sentiment is echoed even more clearly in 1 Corinthians chapter 1. Turn there quickly and we'll wrap this up. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, the Corinthians struggled over the nature and value of wisdom, and they were beginning to fall for the lie that philosophy was more important than theology. Folks, it's not true for a Christian. Philosophy is an interesting study. Apologetics are good as well, but ultimately theology is more important to the Christian. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 18 to 21. For the preaching of the cross is to them that perish foolishness, but unto us which are saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise and will bring to nothing the understanding of the prudent. Where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the disputer of this world? Hath not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? For after that, in the wisdom of God, the world by wisdom knew not God. It pleased God, by the foolishness of preaching, to save them that believe. Point of this passage is, the message preached equals revelation. That which was not known, but known in the mind of God, He reveals to us through the message proclaimed. The wisest scribe on this earth can look up to the heavens and know that there is a God, but not know what His name is. He might think he is Allah. He might think that He is somehow related to a Buddha. He might think that He is a Hindu God. He doesn't know His name. And so God reveals that to us. Revelation brings clarity to us. So Solomon posed this problem, you know, what are we going to do with this? But we really didn't hear about the detail of the last judgment until we got to the New Testament. And in the same way, there is very clear instruction for Christians on how to handle sinful government in Romans 13. Turn back there. Personal harm, political manipulation, delayed justice, and injustice. All of these, probably in the history of America, they have all occurred. During the days of Paul, there was Nero, a butcher who wantonly killed Christians, who was known to be a womanizer and probably a homosexual and everything else when it came to immorality. So what's Paul going to write? You know what? Just ignore what that guy says. And the taxes and the bureaucracy, just ignore that. Go become a monk. Romans 13, verse 1. Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Whosoever therefore resisteth the power resisteth the ordinance of God, and they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. For rulers are not a terror to good works. And we kind of heard some of that in Ecclesiastes 8, because Solomon said, my advice to you is to do what the king says, because if you don't. But rulers are not a terror to good works, but to the evil. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same. For he is the minister of God to thee for good. But if thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain. For he is the minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon them that doeth evil. Many of you were here when I laboriously went through our statement on a Christian's response to government. This was one of the passages the council went through. And when you look at all the New Testament data and you boil it down, there are a couple of different reasons that we should submit to government. In this particular passage, the reason is that government is ordained of God. God created it, and His authority is tied to it. So when you and I, this really is true, when you and I are careless with the laws of the land, we're being careless with the authority of God. Folks, you know something that I've noticed in people and in myself? When I play it loose with the laws of the land, I'm probably playing loose with the laws of the book, too. Someone who is lackadaisical about government and being respectful of government tends to be that way with God's book. Because when you show them a passage, they think it applies to everyone else but them. Be warned. Solomon is realistic. We live in an evil day, and we have to struggle against all the weaknesses of an evil government because we're all sinners, okay? I'm not saying America is evil per se. Please understand me. Remember the context here. But that does not remove from us the responsibility of submission, because that authority is ordained of God. Now, this morning, there's a lot of other details we didn't have time to get into, but I just want to leave you with this. Because we're sinners, husbands, wives, children, government, we need a Savior. Jesus Christ came to redeem citizens, and as redeemed citizens get into government, there is a sense in which government it can be redeemed. There's definitely a connection in the history of America between the Bible and the founding of this country. Often it's overstated, sometimes it's understated. What I'm saying is my opinion, but I want to get to what God says. And that is that Jesus Christ died for you. Are you personally a Christian this morning? Have you ever come to a place in your life where you are confident that on that day of justice, you can point to the cross and the God of justice, who knows your every move and thought, will say, "Yes, I know that you believe in my Son. I know. Enter into your rest." Is that you? Or are you the individual who will be iffy on that day? I mean, you're going to stand before him and you're going to be sweating in your boots. You just, am I going to get in?